uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night moonbat edition of the broadcast. It's Wednesday, February 8th into Thursday, February 9th, 2012. We're live here for you at 12:50 a.m. Central Standard Time. And thanks for being with us here. I'm still getting over my head cold, so bear with me with sniffles and all that stuff. It seems to be getting better and somewhat subsiding today. So, hopefully by tomorrow and the next day, it'll be gone. I was supposed to, tape my newest 2-hour installment of Red Ice Radio with Henrik Palmgren today. But coincidentally enough, Henrik Palmgren was also feeling under the weather today, via a stomach virus thing, but, he has watched the Seawright Volume 2 and he said that he feels there's a lot of, really, really, important information in the film. So he wants to make sure that he's tip top for that. So we're going to be doing that Friday, this coming Friday at noon Central Standard Time. So that's when we'll be taping that. Want to throw that out there. We'll be doing that Friday, noon Central Standard Time. And it's going to be a great show. I really felt like I didn't even get to scratch the surface last time, but we really picked up a lot of new listeners and a whole new fan base from the last show. So I can't wait to do that again. Coming up this Friday. That's going to be good stuff. I can't wait for that. Cause he just seems to have, his ducks in a row whenever he conducts the interview. I like that. And, you know, people have sent me, I've had listeners send me emails asking me stuff about, Red Ice Radio, because of, certain guests that they have on there. And look, I'll say this, and I probably will, if I have time, I will say this on the show Friday, but, I would say this on my show. I would say it on his show in front of Henrik Palmgren because it's the way I feel, and it's the truth. From listening to Red Ice Radio, I've heard some fantastic, great, real information, real good stuff. Hard hitting, real important information. I've also heard some of the most asinine and retarded fucking disinfo horse shit from some of the guests on that show as well. But I think that's the appeal. That's the appeal of the show is because Henrik doesn't put a filter on it. You know what I mean? It forces you to have to be a real researcher and to check out everything that everybody says because you don't know from one guest to the next who's going to be telling you stuff that's legit and checks out or who's going to be telling you stuff that's disinfo and horseshit. So his platform to me, it really makes it to where, if you're not researching everything and checking out everything that each guest says on your own and checking that out, you're going to get caught up in repeating, something that you heard somebody say, and not check it out for yourself to see whether it was true or not. I mean, that's the most, important thing in all of this. That's why I employ people to do that. Especially with the Seawright Volume 2, because there's just so much stuff in there that could be researched in just as much, and you could go on tangents for days and days and days on some of this stuff. That's why I'd encourage people to take notes in that, and why I tried to make some of the research material available in the research packs that we sell with the DVDs and stuff, because you know, that to me is, you know, is the biggest thing. So a lot of people have a lot of problems with some of the guests they have on there. You know, but again, I've heard some great information on there. I've heard some stuff that, you know, is total hogwash, but, it's up to the individual to, you know, filter those things out and to take in what you know from your own research to be truthful. And that's the whole thing. When you hear stuff that sounds, you know, insane to you, don't just, you know, fluff it off or just, you know, dismiss it because it, you know, doesn't fit in with what you think you currently know. Believe me. I mean, I had to come to grips with that myself, right? You know, right when I started my radio show, because I mean, when I started my radio show, I thought, you know, I thought I knew something, you know, I thought I knew some stuff, cause I'd been researching for a long time and, you know, I'd been listening to some radio shows and stuff and I was like, man, nobody's talking about the stuff, you know, that I know about. And then boom, you know, I got the CMP stuff dropped in my lap from, Peter Dale Scott and, you know, things that it forced you into one of those things where, you know, just because you haven't, you know, you haven't heard of it doesn't oftentimes mean that it's hogwash. So, you know, when you hear people say these things that say outlandish to you on some of these radio shows, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you should be researching the most. You know what I mean? Not the stuff that you always agree with, you know. I mean, sometimes you'll hear stuff and you'll, you know, you can, you'll agree with it just because you've researched it and you know the facts verify that. So you don't even have to go look that up because you're like, okay, yeah, that's, you know, that's true. Yeah, yep, that's absolutely true. What he's saying right there is absolutely true, blah, blah, blah. But then oftentimes our reaction when we hear something we think sounds ridiculous to us that doesn't fit into what our spectrum of research has taken us to, sometimes a lot of us have a tendency to just say, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, if that was true, I would have already heard about that. But well, a lot of people try to do that and have done that with the CMP stuff. But then people, you know, a lot more people woken up to it now and figured that out. But I think that that's the most important thing is making sure that, you know, the stuff that you hear that sounds ridiculous to you is the stuff that you go and research the most. I mean, that was what I did with all the no plane stuff, you know. I went and researched all that and, you know, I saw some things that indicated to me that a lot of people were faking a lot of things in these videos, drop frames and all the rest of this stuff. But then there was other evidence that, you know, says that's a possibility. So I, you know, I'm a lot of people are so, I just have never understood why people were so militant against the no plane thing. You know, you don't have to believe it. I don't necessarily believe it. I don't necessarily not believe it because I don't discount anything that these in the realm of scope of what these people do because, folks, they were using advanced technology beyond what we had any knowledge of in 2001 or during 9/11. The stuff that they used on that operation, we're now seeing in places like, you know, Wired Magazine and all these different things. 10 years later, you know, the particle beam laser thing on the Boeing that a lot of people think they used, you know, that thing that, you know, they're just now admitting that they have that. As well as the ability to take off and land planes autonomously by computer control. And supposedly on 9/11, this was the first operation in which the powers that be turned over the operation to not in human hands, but into the hands of this massive AI computer system. Caesar system, because they found more effectiveness in operations being computer controlled. And it's interesting, a lot of the stuff, you know, from whatever it was that hit the Pentagon, was it a guided missile, whatever else that, to the Shanksville thing, to the towers, to buildings. I mean, when you think about it and look at it from the standpoint of it all being computer controlled and everything being on a sequence in timers and everything being, the planes being controlled by that, the whole thing being run by a computer, it really, and you start looking at the video clips and stuff, man, it's unbelievable. I suggest doing that sometime. It's unbelievable when you do that and go back and look at the footage again and you think about it in terms of, you know, a massive computer system running all this stuff, and you're just like, oh my God, you know, because you couldn't have seen that at the time, really. When you go back and you look at it now, I mean, from the way that Building 7 came down and the way that it seemed to be very timed, the way the buildings came down. I mean, everything just seemed like it was running on an algorithm. And so, you know, these kind of next level things that they're doing are very much there. So, and so I think that to say that, you know, okay, I don't believe in no plane theory, this, you know, it's not possible. The way that people have dismissed that and the just the real attacking nature, it really always was suspect to me. In fact, it made me, I mean, it made me go from thinking it was total bullshit to wanting to investigate it myself. And it, believe me, there is a lot of bullshit surrounding it. The people have made a lot of fake stuff to try to back up their story on it. So I think there's an operation to both sides of it, but I think there's, that's why they're trying to create so much cognitive dissonance around the 9/11 thing with the no plane theory stuff, is because they did in fact use some next level tech to pull that thing off. And in order to keep people from really finding out what that is, so they won't notice it when they use it next time, they create all this cognitive dissonance and create all this division over this thing without leading people any closer to what the real truth is. So that's my standpoint on that. Thanks for being with us here tonight. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. It's www.theglobalreality.com. You'll find news, all the news up there. Manhydra does a great job keeping the news updated up there on the website. So thanks to him for keeping the news and the archive stuff uploaded and updated for you guys every day there as well. We also have the listen tab. That's where you find the link to listen to the stream. So if you're listening on an archive later on YouTube or something, you can always check out the show. It'll always rebroadcast right after the current one ends. All my documentaries are up there to watch for free, as well as Secret Right Volume 2, that you can watch like the first hour and 49 minutes of. It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes total. You can watch that up there, or you can buy the DVD or the Blu-ray up there as well. Video clips, some of the different books. There's a books tab up there now, and those have the various audiobooks that we've done that I've read that some of our listeners have been kind enough to make you know, audiobooks out of, taking and cutting down and condensed down, taking all the shows and made them into doing that. It takes some time to do. So we thank so much to our listeners who've done that and sent those in. So those are up there. You can find like the Lost Book of Enki and Emerald Tablets of Thoth, Gods of Eden, William Bramley's up there. All those are great. I mean, those, I got to tell you, those series of books, I've gotten more emails and found new listeners than from doing those books than anything I've ever done. It's been unbelievable, the reach that that those. I want to thank everybody who made those files and got those up on YouTube. That's, man, I just getting so many emails now from people who are saying that they found the show from those, you know, clips. They go and do a search and try to find the PDF of Gods of Eden, and they come across the video, and lo and behold. Because I'm getting people now who, you know, who are coming on as listeners who have found me through the Gods of Eden or Lost Book of Enki or any of that stuff. Who don't even know anything about Alex Jones or any of that stuff. You know, they just found that and now they're listeners. That's just fantastic. So I'm amazed to see how our reach continues to grow from these audiobooks. And that's why I'm going to continue doing that. I'm going to read everything, man. Fuck it. Let's just get it out there. It's just been, people have just been responding so much to it. I'm just going to read everything. Like I said, I promised that a while back, didn't I? A couple of years ago. We're just going to go through the mystery teachings ourselves here live on the air. We'll just, we'll just go through all the books. We'll go through them all. I'll give you my take on them. We'll have our own little on-air mystery school initiation here, you know? I mean, I don't know what else to do. But I know that every time I read one of these books, this information reaches people I never thought it would reach. So I can't stop. That's just, I got to keep doing that, because the response that I've gotten from these readings has just been phenomenal, man. Phenomenal. Off the charts big as far as just the way that it had, that, I mean, people have been sending me some touching emails. I mean, you know, I've read some of them here on air. A lot, some of them people don't want me to read on air, but, and I respect that, but you know, I mean, it's amazing. It's really amazing. People are really, like, I really reach people, you know, because I've been successful in doing what I've been trying to do, which is to show people that, yes, there are other people out here like you. There are other people out here who think like you. There are other people out here who have figured this out. There are other people out there that are fighting for this. You thought you were all alone. You're not all alone. We're out here. We've been looking for you. Now you found us. This is it. That's, you know, and it's amazing, because I get all these emails, and that's what people say, you know, that they thought they were the only one in the whole world that you know, was into this stuff and researched this stuff. I mean, that's been my only goal, is to, hopefully inspire other people to want to throw their voice into the gauntlet. And we need as many voices as we can speaking up about this stuff. Way too many spectators. This, you know, I've said it once, I've said it twice, I'll say it again. Put this on a bumper sticker, put this on a t-shirt, and put theglobalreality.com under it. You ready? Here's your big moneymaker right here. Enlightenment is not a spectator sport. It's not a spectator sport. You have to be involved, and you can't just sit back and watch everybody else learn everything or do all the research. You have to be involved in that yourself. If you want to send emails into the show anytime when I'm live or anytime when I'm not, love mail, hate mail, you've been getting some of that lately. Let me preface this by saying we have a lot of great listeners in the UK and in Britain. So I don't want to disenfranchise anybody here with what I'm about to say, or because there are some good people in the UK and Britain. Illuminated Scam is one of our listeners. He does all our daily archives on YouTube. Does a fantastic job of that, and a great service to the broadcast doing that, reaching a lot of people that we wouldn't reach otherwise. It's just a fantastic thing that he does with that. He's in the UK. He's a great dude. I mean, seriously, I'd give that dude anything. He's a fucking cool dude. But I don't know what it is, man. Some of these fucking Brits are just cocksuckers. I think I've gotten some of the most hate-filled vitriol from fucking Brits than I've gotten from anybody else. I don't know what the fucking problem is here. Folks from Ireland, they fucking love me. Folks from Australia, they fucking love me. Scotland, they fucking love me. New Zealand, they fucking love me. England, I don't know what the fucking problem is. Is it because you motherfuckers are pissed because you still hadn't got from out from underneath the crown? Because, you know, as fucked up as shit is in my country, at least I don't live under the crown, motherfucker. You know, I could at least say that about my forefathers and whoever they were. At least they had goddamn sense enough to get away from the fucking lizard queen. But seriously, some of the most hate-filled... Man, look, here's the thing. If you don't like me and you don't like my show and you don't like what I talk about, then don't fucking listen. I just don't understand the logic behind people who want to send, bullshit, cussing, blah, 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 you're this, you're a motherfucker, you're this, blah, 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 about the content of my show and the things I talk about. It's very simple. Just don't listen. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I have never understood why someone would listen to something that they totally hated. There's obviously, whenever that happens, and I find this to be the case 90% of the time, usually in that kind of a situation where somebody sends you an email like that, it's because either they're jealous or, they don't have the balls enough to do something themselves. And so, you know, they're mad at you because you do. That's generally what it is. But Brits, I don't know what it is, man. People from Canada are great. Just some real shit talking. Limey pricks. I don't know. I've got more hate-filled nonsense. I don't know what the deal is. And I got to tell you something else too. I don't know if this means anything. And again, this could go back to the whole living under the crown thing as well. We've gotten support and donations and stuff from people, you know, all over the world, all over the planet. And, you know, little bits and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, $500 or something from somebody from Germany or, you know, that's happened once. But people from the UK, for the most part, I got to say, I think with the exception of maybe one or two, and they were really small amounts, like $3 and $5, never seen anybody from the UK or Britain donate any sort of substantial amount to the broadcast. Most of them, it's people from the United States. But it's just funny that, I mean, it's a fact. For as far as my broadcast is concerned, the cheapest, stingiest, non-donating motherfuckers that are a big part of my listening broadcast come from the UK. That's a fact. But have a go. Have a go, you yank. Come on. Come on, have a go. You wanker. Come on. Come on, have a go down at the pub, you yank. Let's go. Cheerio, mate.
I don't know. It's probably because, I don't know. My ancestors come from like Germany and Ireland. And so I think it's some of those traits that are anti-British crown come out of me. I think that's what turns off the Brits for the most part. But I don't mean to throw the baby out with the bathwater and denounce all Brits, but I just had to be honest about those facts. The most hate in Vitterall comes from the UK, and the least amount of any kind of support and donations comes from the UK. But here's another interesting tidbit. Guess where I've sold the least amount, at least amount being zero. And I guess it's kind of strange. Or not strange, because I guess I haven't sold a DVD in every city and every town, but, you know, a lot of the major ones, yeah. But I think it's hilarious that the only place that I have not so far shipped a DVD of the Zero Volume 2, and I don't know if I did any of Volume 1, maybe one, but so far Volume 2, I've shipped no DVD or Blu-rays at all to Austin, Texas. Now, this is hilarious to me, and I think... It makes me think that there is definitely some, like, you know, Harp Jones mind control waves in the Austin area, because I find that unbelievable. They call Austin like the conspiracy capital of the world. And so in the conspiracy capital of the world, and Austin, you know what? Fuck that. Austin is not the conspiracy capital of the world, motherfucker. Dallas is. Big D, motherfucker. Fuck Austin. Did you motherfuckers kill the president in fucking Austin? No. No. You motherfuckers killed the president in Dallas. I rest my case. But seriously, Dallas is the conspiracy capital of the world. It's where, you know, the whole thing started here. Ground zero, man. Austin. So I guess, you know, it can also be the conspiracy capital of Texas. Considered to be the mecca for truthers. Not one single DVD, not one single... That tells me that every single person who is somewhat awake in Austin is completely fucking brainwashed to Jones and Ron Paul, which makes sense. It totally makes sense. I fucking hate Austin. God, I fucking hate it. It's a pit. It used to be a cool place till the yuppies and Hollywood and the corporations moved in and turned it into a fucking cesspool. Man, I just thought that was an interesting stat, you know? Let's see what we have here in the news tonight. I thought this was hilarious. I had to read this. Republican Ron Paul said frontrunner Mitt Romney's inability to brush back challenges and votes Tuesday opens up the door to him and others looking to deny the former Massachusetts governor of the party's presidential nomination. Now, we've seen Ron Paul speaking at all sorts of, these establishment locations. Most of the time, he always speaks at Loyola, the Jesuit University, and Georgetown, another Jesuit university, Freemason University. All that stuff and those connections combined with his, you know, the newsletters and the stuff, the anonymous stuff that came out and those, you know, Jesuit universities, it just doesn't look good with his most recent appearance. Listen to this. In a brief appearance at Coon Rapids Middle School. Now, wait a minute here. Let me get it. Coon, you guys couldn't come up with a better spot for his appearance than at Coon Rapids Middle School in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I don't know. I don't know about you, but, you know, first Loyola, then Georgetown, now Coon Rapids. I mean, with these newsletters, that to me, that just doesn't look good. That just doesn't look good at all. You couldn't find some other place other than Coon Rapids. I mean, they might as well give this guy a fucking, you know, white hood and a burning cross behind him. I'm Ron Paul. I approve this burning cross. Jesus Christ, Coon Rapids, huh? Ron Paul's at Coon Rapids today, denying allegations that he's a racist. We're here to talk at Coon Rapids about how we're not white supremacists. Oh, man, really? I don't know. I think if I'm the campaign manager, we go to find some place that doesn't have a racial slur in its title. I don't know. That's just me. If I was out to win, I wouldn't go speak in the town that, you know, has a racial slur in it. That just looks like bad. That's just bad business. You know what I mean? That's just bad business. Oh, man. So they're back in the news again, talking about this is just hilarious synchronicity. First, you're saying that now they've determined that the polar ice caps and stuff are not melting near the rate that the global warming alarmists have been telling us. But simultaneously with that, they're also telling us that we need to start doing large scale geoengineering of the planet, which they've already been doing for a long time. If you've been paying attention and if you've read the documents that they put out and the textbooks they put out where they talk about doing it, it's not a conspiracy theory. And now they're running this operation to try and convince us that we have the public has to fund these large scale geoengineering projects to save ourselves from global warming. So essentially what they're trying to do is they're trying to get to take this already ongoing in the background project, geoengineering project, chemtrails, HARP, all the rest of it. And now they're creating a PR campaign with now Bill Gates heading up the PR campaign to take geoengineering to the public level. Because, see, these guys are getting tired of footing the bill for this. So now they're going to end the conspiracy theory and to try and, you know, deflect information. Because look, geoengineering, weather modification, all that's only one element of what they're doing with this. The other things that they're doing, they're keeping a lot tighter of a lid on. But the reason people focus so much on the weather modification end of it is because it's the one end of it that we know that we can prove that they are indeed doing. But this ongoing program is costing so much money that in order to for them not to have to foot the bill for it anymore, they take this thing public. They tell us it's to keep ourselves safe. And then they bring in this global carbon tax. And we foot the bill for something that's already been going on for a great many years. Bill Gates backs climate scientists lobbying for large-scale geoengineering. Other wealthy individuals have also funded a series of reports into the future use of technologies to geoengineer the climate as if it's not already going on, you fucking idiots. Go and look outside. A small group of leading climate scientists, financially supported by billionaires, including Bill Gates, are lobbying governments and international bodies to back experiments into manipulating the climate on a global scale to avoid catastrophic climate change. Oh my God. That just sounds insane. It's already going on. It's been going on. And it doesn't have anything to do with catastrophic climate change that we're causing. It has to do with catastrophic climate change that's happening on a natural time scale. They're trying to avoid the inevitable because it's going to bring it. I mean, look, if we go from being third dimensional and we go into being fourth dimensional light beings, their supremacy goes away. You see, they don't want this stuff to happen that's supposed to happen on a timescale because then they don't have anything to rule over. The scientists who advocate geoengineering methods such as spraying millions of tons of reflective particles or sulfur dioxide, that they're already doing, 30 miles above the Earth, argue that a plan B for climate change will be needed if the UN and politicians cannot agree to making the necessary cuts in greenhouse gases, and say the U.S. government and others should pay for a major program of international research. Solar geoengineering techniques are highly controversial. While some climate scientists believe they may prove a quick and relatively cheap way to slow global warming, others fear that when conducted in the upper atmosphere, they could irrevocably alter rainfall patterns and interfere with the Earth's climate. That's already been going on for a long time. You know, what this also could mean is it also could mean that they've been doing this in secret for a long time to keep us unaware of really how dire the circumstances are with the changes that are going on with our sun, which also reflects changes on our planet. And So it really kind of seems now that, there's really no other way to say it. The chemtrails and stuff that we've seen so far, really, in my opinion, if all this stuff that they're talking about here is true, is kind of like an you ain't seen nothing yet type situation. Like, we think we've seen it bad already with chemtrails. In order to do the type of operation that they want to do to keep our atmosphere intact the way it is going to require an operation on a greater scale than what they're even already doing. At that point, it would be impossible to keep it a secret anymore because you'd have so many goddamn planes in the air at all times doing this geoengineering stuff. So, I think that's what this is. I think that they've been paying for this in the background, black op budgets and the rest of it. I mean, folks, a lot of these planes have been identified as NATO planes. Now, this is a worldwide effort. This is not just an effort that's relegated to one country or one area. This stuff's been going on for a long time. It's been a worldwide project in secret that they've been doing to keep us from the facts about changes in the sun. Because everybody talks about pole shifts and all this stuff, but supposedly the sun is actually what's going through a pole shift right now. And that's why we're seeing all these fireballs and meteors and all the rest of this stuff. It's just launching. I mean, these things are made of metal. They're being drawn into the sun. As the sun's poles start to flip, the magnetic force of it just ejects them back out. I'm getting all these emails of people seeing green fireballs. Man, I've been seeing those green fireballs for like 5 or 6 years. You always see them more on the heavy chemtrail days. They don't look like any meteors you've ever seen. Then, of course, last week I saw that big, thing they said was a meteor breaking up in the atmosphere. But they're not going to allow their supremacy to be challenged for anything. So they'll continue to lie to us and tell us that this is, to save us from man-made global warming, so long as they don't have to tell us about these natural cycles of the sun and natural procession of planetary systems and life and how these different changes also sometimes equate to changes in the overall makeup of the beings that are inhabiting the planet during this time. I mean, all the ancient texts talk about this from going up from one dimension to another. And I just find it highly, highly irregular that on top of all this, we've got, fluoride in our water, which calcifies your pineal gland. You've got MSG, which messes with your DNA, GMO foods, which messes with your DNA. It doesn't allow 12-strand DNA activation and all that. I mean, that combined with this geoengineering stuff, I mean, it really does make the case that they are trying to keep some natural phenomenon, some natural event that, yes, may mean the end of, well, as the mind said, the end of the known world. Think about it, the end of the known world, the end of the third dimensional world, and we transition into 12-dimensional light beings, or something like 12-strand DNA activation, fourth dimensional light beings. I mean, because if you read the esoteric text, what they did, the fourth dimension is, I mean, you're talking about different rules here. The need for a hierarchy and the need for all that would no longer be there. Everything would be exposed. Everything would be revealed. This stuff with Bill Gates spearheading this stuff, man, this just tells me that, the changes that are going on with our sun, with our planet, are reaching such an extreme rate now that they're going to have to, it's going to be ridiculous. You're going to see chemtrail spray planes everywhere on the face of the planet, every moment of the day, in the near future. Because now that they're taking this public, it's going to be no holds barred. Let's see what else we have here. Neuroscience could mean soldiers controlling weapons with minds. Again, another thing we know they've had for a long time, but now they're rolling it out because it's going to be the norm here very soon. Soldiers could have their minds plugged directly into weapon systems, undergo brain scans during recruitment, and take courses of neural stimulation to boost their learning if the armed forces embrace the latest developments in neuroscience to hone the performance of their troops. This is from the London Guardian. The scenarios are described in a report into the military and law enforcement uses of neuroscience published on Tuesday, which also highlights a raft of legal and ethical concerns that innovations in the field may bring. Yeah, and then all the soldiers will be plugged in to the neuro net, be plugged into Skynet, right into Caesar, into the AI computer, and bam, locked, boom. Every soldier controlled by the mainframe AI computer system. You don't have to worry about that soldier who has a heart, who won't pull the trigger on that little child and woman. You don't have to worry about that anymore. Boom, computer, right, real time, baby. As soon as that impulse kicks in, computer system sends a fucking program, boom, boom, kid and mama are dead. Don't have to worry about it. And they'll feed drugs wirelessly that use frequencies and programs that go through this suit that act as sedatives and drugs that keep them, you know, at an even keel every time they have to do something like that. This is genius. The report by the Royal Society of the UK's National Academy of Science says that while the rapid advance of neuroscience is expected to benefit society and improve treatments for brain disease and mental illness, it also has substantial security applications that should be carefully analyzed. The report's authors also anticipate new designer drugs, this is what I'm talking about, new designer drugs that boost performance, make captives more talkative, and make enemy troops fall asleep. Neuroscience will have a more impact in our future. People can see a lot of possibilities, but so far, very few have made their way to the actual use. All these forwards start out this way. You have a groundswell of ideas being suddenly you get a step change. So, yeah, they're going right forward with that one. Let's see what else we have. You guys seen this show now where they're showing people extreme home bunkers, National Geographic show, Doomsday Preppers. Yeah, they're the show that's coming on where they show people's bug out bunkers they've built to survive the apocalypse. This is hilarious. They're just ratchet. This feels like Y2K all over again, doesn't it? Oh, man. Wine made with 4.5 billion year old meteorite. Who would want to drink rock? Does rock turn to vinegar after it sets out too long? I mean, what? I'm confused here. This is one variety of wine that's likely to leave you feeling spaced out. Meteorito has been made from Cabernet Sauvignon grapes and 4.5 billion year old meteorite and represents a blending of two hobbies. The maker is Norwich born Ian Hutchin, who runs a vineyard and astronomy center in Chile called the Centro Astronomica Taga Taga. The space rock measures 3 inches long and was found in the Atacama Desert, northern Chile, in what is believed to have crashed 6,000 years ago. A private collector from the U.S. donated to Mr. Hutchin, who makes the red wine by putting the meteorite in a wooden barrel with the grapes for 25 days. Mr. Hutchin told Wired UK the idea behind the project was to blend my passion for both astronomy and enology in a real, physical way rather than just a symbolic one, and give everybody the chance to touch an element of space and taste particles of the birth of the solar system via a very good handcrafted wine. He added that the biggest hurdle in making the wine was to make sure that it didn't taste metallic in a bad way, since meteors are composed of iron and nickel. Yeah. Mr. Hutchin says that the wine is livelier than non-meteorite wine. It costs €7 a bottle, and so far 10,000 liters have been fermented. All right. Well, shit. I'll take some. Let's get fucked up on meteorite. Woo! Heavy metals. They're always good to put in your system. Not. Yesterday was the 200th anniversary of the New Madrid earthquakes. And pretty interesting now that area is starting to become active yet again. 200 years ago, on Tuesday, the central Mississippi River Valley was violently shaken by the first of a series of three earthquakes of magnitude 7 to 8. And hundreds of aftershocks greater than magnitude 3. By March 15, 1812, an estimated 2,000 aftershocks had been felt, but it is likely there were tens of thousands more that were not felt or otherwise noted. The first of these quakes struck on December 16th around 2:15 a.m. near present-day Blytheville, Arkansas, waking residents located up to 900 miles away across what is now the eastern United States. According to reports of boat captains and others on the Mississippi River, the December 16th quake and its aftershocks caused the river to fill with debris as tree-covered banks caved into the river. Other reports said the river flooded large tracts of land, created temporary waterfalls, and even ran backwards in some places. The second of the three major earthquakes estimated at a magnitude 7.5 occurred on January 23, 1812 at about 9:15 a.m. Similar to the December 1811 earthquake, this event was also widely felt. Damage occurred in that area at about 232,000 square miles. The third and probably the most widely felt of the three major earthquakes occurred on February 7th, 1812, at about 3 a.m. There were several destructive shocks that day, the last and largest estimated a magnitude 7.7. As a result, the town of New Madrid, Missouri, was severely damaged. We know the 1811-1812 earthquake sequence was not a one-time event. The New Madrid earthquakes covered the region with sand blows, thousands of which remain today and can be seen as large, light-colored sandy patches in agricultural fields. By digging into the sand blows, geologists found widespread evidence of prehistoric sand blows telling similar sequences of earthquakes around 1450, 900, and 300 AD. The U.S. Geological Survey Earthquake Hazard Map, which is a compilation of scientific studies over the past 40 years, demonstrates the earthquake hazard revealed by this earthquake today. A risk of a similar sequence of earthquakes exists in the New Madrid seismic zone today and threatens Alabama, Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, and Tennessee. Recent U.S. Geological Survey projections place the likelihood of a magnitude 6 or higher earthquake at about 25 to 50% over the next few decades, and place the likelihood of a magnitude 7 or higher earthquake at 10%. With large cities like Memphis, St. Louis, and Nashville well within range of a large-scale New Madrid earthquake, understanding the science of earthquakes in the area's geologic history helps communities prepare for earthquake hazards and prevent them from becoming catastrophes. So there you go. Yep. I've been talking about that for a while. Let's see what else we have. Details of secret experiments by scientists who've created the most deadly form of bird flu in the lab will inevitably be leaked, potentially into the hands of terrorists, an expert has warned. Oh, really? I love how they... Why are they just telling us this? Oh, don't worry. They'll be leaked, inevitably leaked, potentially in the hands of terrorists. Don't worry. You know, because everybody was outraged when they started making this stuff and toying with stuff in the first place. Now they're telling us to go ahead and expect the details to be leaked and be in the hands of terrorists. So basically, you know, expect that, you know, it's going to be leaked out and we'll blame it on terrorists and blame it on Al-Qaeda, just like we did 9/11, and a bunch of people will die. Yeah, expect it to happen. It's an inevitability. Jesus. These guys are getting some balls these days, aren't they? What do you guys think about all this stuff going on with the birth control thing and Obama and the Catholic Church? It's getting pretty heated, huh? I think this is interesting because I don't know this, you know, this public thing. I mean, they're getting pretty heated about this. I don't know, man. I'll just all this stuff. Remember when Obama first got elected, they were selling plates on TV with his face on it with, they had a coin, I think too, and a plate, but it had like, Obama on one side and JFK on the other. I mean, right when the guy first got elected, I was like, my God, you know, it was like they were telling us from the very beginning, get ready. We're going to JFK him. I don't know, man. It just makes me wonder if that's what they're going to do here. You know, you have this, public upheaval with the Catholic Church and Obama. He doesn't seem to be bending on the issue at all. They get one of their crazy, whack nut, Sovereign Military Order of Malta-controlled Jesuit MK Ultra, you know, Jonesites with a We Are Change shirt to, you know, go after Obama. And boom, the Catholic Church gets what they want. And they just use their scapegoat of the, you know, crazy 9/11 truther to get the job done. Stranger things have happened. Wouldn't surprise me. Researcher developed smartphone technology to sense depression. Really? No thanks. So now your iPhone, your iPad will be able to sense if you are depressed or not, and probably be able to send a message via Wi-Fi to some, you know, medical industrial complex controlled pharmacy that will then prescribe you a medication. My God, 1984 is here, isn't it, folks? Researchers at Northwestern University are developing a smartphone that can sense whether you're falling victim to depression. And who's, you know, whose guidelines are we using here? I mean, whose standards and are we using here to determine whether or not someone's depressed or not? People get depressed. People get down sometimes. But most of this stuff is a result of the society and the way that we live our lives. It's contrary to our nature. And so that's what causes these things. But, you know, drugging people out and just numbing everything out is not the answer. We're trying to develop individual algorithms for each user that can determine specific states. So their location, where they are, their activity, their social content, who they're with, what they're engaged in, their mood. So they're going to be able to, you know, okay, they're going to use algorithms from all the apps that you use and everything that you do on your smartphone or whatever, and probably your iPad too, because the iPad uses the same operating system as the phone does, same with the Android phones. So, you know, so they're going to build algorithms off this and determine whether or not you're, so I guess if you, you know, play menacing, ominous tones on your little Moog app, which I have for the iPad, which is fantastic, by the way, you know, you might be depressed. This is just ridiculous. We're talking about these strange lights in the sky, and there's been a rash of them. They've got something going on in Russia that's got the web all in a tiff. The Russian web was ablaze with bizarre theories today at an extraordinary explosion seen by thousands of commuters in St. Petersburg. It must have seemed like the end of the world was near when motorists driving along this busy motorway saw a huge flash of light up in the night sky on the horizon. So far, conspiracy theories of Martians and bomb testing have emerged to explain the astonishing sight. However, the reality was far less exciting. The flash was a result of an explosion at an electrical power plant in St. Petersburg and what has been described as a technical malfunction by officials. No one was hurt in the incident. The amazing footage was recorded by one driver listening to John Lennon as he was stuck in a traffic jam. Footage has gone viral on YouTube and other blogs and social networking sites, attracting a flurry of online conspiracy theories. It's the Martians landing, said one comment, while several others are also suggesting a spaceship had landed on Russia's second city and former imperial capital. Another commenter added, I know precisely what this is. Tests of a neutron bomb in St. Petersburg. Yeah, very well could be. It certainly looks like it could have been a neutron bomb. But who knows? Drop the link for you there. What else tonight? Let's see. Oh, here's another great piece of news for you. You guys are going to love this one. Wow, yeah. We're all going to want to sign up after this. DARPA implants could track your stress levels 24/7. Oh, great. Yeah, why monitor your stress levels yourself and do things to ease your stress yourself when you can have DARPA put an implant in you and do it for you? I mean, come on, it's a no-brainer, right? Plenty of geeks are already obsessed with self-tracking, from monitoring sleep rhythms to graphing caffeine intake versus productivity. Now the Department of Defense's far-out research agency is after the ultimate kind of quantified self. Soldiers with implanted body sensors that keep intimate tabs on their health around the clock. In a new call for research, DARPA is asking for a proposal to devise prototype implantable biosensors. Once inserted under a soldier's skin, DARPA wants the sensor to provide real-time accurate measurements of DOD-relevant biomarkers, including stress hormones like cortisol and compounds that signal inflammation like histamine. Now, this is the same thing we were talking about in the other article, but it's has more to do with what I was mentioning about sending the drugs and stuff like that directly into the suit. That other one was about controlling weapons. But see, this one is more about the implants also sending drugs into their system as well. I wanted to make it clear that there was two separate articles about two separate things, and I wasn't just pulling that stuff about, you know, the drugs being injected into their body through these computer algorithms. I wanted to make sure you knew I wasn't pulling that out of thin air. Just to be clear, two separate articles. Implantable sensors are also the latest of several Pentagon-backed ventures to track a soldier's health. DARPA's already looked into tracking nutritional biomarkers to evaluate troops' diets. And as a part of the agency's Peak Soldier Performance Program, DARPA studied how one's genes impact physical ability and tried to manipulate cellular mitochondria to boost the body's energy levels. Sensors alone won't make troops stronger, smarter, or more resilient, but they probably offer the kind of information that could.
Yeah, well, we know what they got, motherfuckers.
Underage lovers, transvestite tendencies, and a porn stash featuring Joan Crawford. A new book exposes the secret world of J. Edgar Hoover. That about says it all right there, doesn't it? Underage lovers, transvestite tendencies, and a porn stash featuring Joan Crawford. That's just what J. Edgar Hoover liked, yes. What a freak. Yeah, I got a gold-plated telephone, wore a dress. J. Edgar Hoover assembled the largest collection of pornography in history. Come on. Really? I don't know, man. You can tell me fucking that J. Edgar Hoover's Yank Bank fucking beat out Hugh Hefner's or, you know, fucking what's his nuts from Hustler. I mean, come on. Really? J. Edgar Hoover had the largest Yank Bank in history, huh? The former director of the FBI built up a vast stock of adult films made by Hollywood stars before they were famous, which he watched for his own titillation or to blackmail them. They included one starring a very young Frank Sinatra, made in 1934. He shot when he was a penniless wannabe actor slumming it in New York. Hoover was also partial to classically erotic lithographs depicting men with giant phalluses or full frontal nudes, which he hung on his bathroom walls. He was a freak. He was a Freemason, too. Man, god damn, Hoover was a freak. Hoover was also partial to classically erotic lithographs. Among the book's other revelations are that Hoover and one of his close friends both had sex with a male suspect caught by the FBI before letting him go and making his case disappear. Hoover has long been the subject of speculation about his private life, in particular, that he was a transvestite and enjoyed gay relationship with his close friend and FBI associate director Clyde Tolson. Yep, well, it's all true. But he also had one of the best quotes that really sums it up and really let the cat out of the bag there for a minute. The individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous he dare not believe that it exists. J. Edgar Hoover. Yeah, well, he summed up the whole truth right there. That's the individual's handicapped. See, they can't, they're handicapped. They hear about the conspiracy and it's so monstrous, they dare not believe it exists. And that's what allows them to keep control in a nutshell. I mean, he just said it all with that statement, didn't he? I've been talking about over the past couple of months, I think I mentioned this last week, why all of a sudden there's been all these new articles with stuff coming out, new revelations about JFK. And none of the stuff that's been coming out has really been new revelations. But it seems there's been a rash of this, and I mentioned that it seemed to me like an operation was going on. It seems to me that something was happening here because they seem to be rolling, coming out with all this new information and acting like they're telling us stuff when really they're not telling us anything we didn't already know. But I've seen two interesting things that have come out over the past couple of weeks that seem to be sort of, leaning towards being negative. And almost lean towards, you know, defaming JFK after it's not enough that they killed this guy. They're now going to fucking continue to defame him and defame his character almost 50 years after the fact. So as I said before, you know, I already suspected something was going on here. I think there very well may be some new classified JFK stuff going to come out real soon that's going to implicate the real assassins. And they're running this operation now to, you know, essentially defame his character after he's already dead. Teen mistress addresses relationship, pulls Cold War fears in memoir. She always called him Mr. President, not Jack. He refused to kiss her on the lips when they made love. Yeah, that's because he, you know, you're his little hoe. He just, you know, he's going to jizz in your mouth and shit. He don't want to kiss your ass. They go fucking rinse your mouth out. Come on. No, don't fault him for that, you know? But Mimi Alford, a White House intern from New Jersey, was smitten nonetheless. She was in the midst of an 18-month affair with the most powerful man in the world, sharing not only John F. Kennedy's bed, but also some of his darkest and most intimate moments. Ooh, he was fucking the 18-year-old secretary. She was just a teenager. Now listen to this. In her explosive new tell-all, Once Upon a Secret, My Affair with President John F. Kennedy and Its Aftermath, Alford, now a 69-year-old grandmother and retired New York City church administrator, sets the record straight in searingly candid detail. Now, this is the part that gets me. This is the fucking, I'm not even going to have to read any more of this goddamn article after this to seal the deal. You ready for this? I hope you're sitting down. In the summer of 1962, Alford was a slender, golden-haired 19-year-old debutante whose finishing school polish and blue blood connections had landed her a job in the White House press office. Finishing school polish and blue blood connections. So right there in a nutshell, they tell you what we already know. They implant these blue bloods into these positions, especially the young, hot little females, to work inside the White House press offices so that these, they can keep the chain going. See, they hope that in these situations, what they were probably hoping for is that JFK would knock her up. And they'd get, you know, they'd probably kill her and then put the kid up for adoption, and nobody would ever know what happened to the kid, but the kid would go on to be, you know, a blue blood and probably be, you know, Justin Timberlake or somebody like that. But yeah, man, I mean, that they just let it out of the bag right there. Putting the blue bloods in there, blue blood connections. Unbelievable stuff. See if I have any other pressing articles here tonight. Oh, one more on the Kennedy thing. How Kennedy bought 1,200 hand-rolled Cuban cigars just hours before he ordered a blockade of communist state 50 years ago. So here they are again, dragging up that old JFK was a commie shit from the old John Birch Society 1960 days again. I mean, really? They are just scraping the bottom there. Why are they going out of their way to defame him all of a sudden and also come out with all this supposed new JFK material that's not telling us anything? I told you guys, you heard me a couple weeks ago, man. I told you guys something was going on with this. And these two articles just confirmed that for me. Oh, let's dredge up that old JFK was a commie thing. Let's talk about that. Let's not talk about the evidence. Let's not talk about John Russolo, who was paid by the FBI to infiltrate the John Birch Society and had multiple people say, we are going to kill him in John Birch Society meetings in Dallas. Those books are almost impossible to get your hands on. Now they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. I looked, I tried to buy them for the movie, but I talk about that in the Cigarette Volume 2. So something's going on. There's something that's going to come out real soon. And these guys are running some damage control, trying to further defame his image because, you know, they don't want people to take seriously some information that's going to come out, or maybe already has come out. I mean, shit. Not to toot my own horn, but I think some of the JFK information that I put in the Secret Volume 2 is better than any of the fucking JFK movies that have been made up to this point. Facebook is good for you, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, you've heard it here first. It's in the news. Must be true. Facebook is good for you. Social networks relax the heart rate and trigger a natural high. Oh, thank you, Facebook. I'm relaxed and I get a natural high from being on. I don't get a natural high and get relaxed from being on Facebook. I get stressed out and want to pull my fucking hair out from ads and bullshit and content-specific advertising and spam and viruses and requests from fucking Farmville. So I don't know, man. I'd have to not agree with that. But you see the how they're trying to spin this now. They come out with this right after Facebook goes up for IPO, right? You know, right when it goes public. Now they're going to run a campaign to Facebook's actually good for you. It lowers your heart rate. Yay! I mean, that's slick. I guess that's a kind of that's the kind of news you can buy when you got, you know, billions and billions, 500 billion IPO. You know, I saw one of these things a few years ago, and it looked identical to this one in the picture, and I've talked about this before on the show. And people said I was crazy when I told them this. I saw this in a shed at my parents' old house 4 or 5 years ago. And this thing was flying around, dude, and it was like dive bombing. And I would swear this thing was a drone. It was a fucking... it was a moth. It looked exactly like that, in like that picture I just dropped in the chat room. And I was like, man, that's a fucking drone. That thing was a drone. It seemed like it was a drone. Well, listen to this. Researchers at MIT have successfully implanted a neural probe into a fist-sized moth and could steer the moth using electrical signals. The scientists can tell the moths to turn left and right and even how hard to turn, as much as you might steer a remote-controlled plane. It's the first fruit of an $18.5 million U.S. government project aimed at controlling insects using electrical signals. I think they've had this for a long time, man. They've had the robo-roach and all that stuff for years. But I swear to God, man, I saw one of those things around my parents' house 4 or 5 years ago, and I knew at the time it was a fucking robot. Let's see what else we have here tonight. Can yoga classes kill you? The startling question posed by a leading science writer. Downward dog for back pain, sun salutations for an energy boost. Yoga has become the workout for a healthy mind and body and is the exercise of choice for endless celebrities, including Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. But is the ancient art form as healthy as we like to think? On yesterday's Today program on Radio 4, New York Times science writer William Broad, the author of a controversial new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards, asked whether yoga, when taught incorrectly, might have the potential to kill. Well, yeah, I mean, anything can fuck you up if you're not doing it in the right way. But see, this is the part of that attitude where, you know, let's ban anything that has a possibility of, you know, a dumbass using it in a bad way. Just like they want to do with drugs and just like they do with guns and everything else, let's not have people do yoga. Let's have people do pills. So of course they're going to start this fucking PR propaganda campaign against that. I mean, it's obvious. I've seen this coming for a while. Anything and everything that you can do for your body that does not require you to put in one of the medical industrial complex poisons into your body, they are going to come out and send the dogs after. End of story. I mean, there's really not much left to say about it other than that. That's just all there is to it. All right, well, we're going to take a break, come back, and we will be reading out of Zachariah Sitchin's The End of Days for you here tonight. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. Please support our work. We haven't got any donations this week. We're really low. We're almost down to zero on the bank account, folks. We really need some support right now. Help us out if you can. TheGlobalReality.com. Donate button is there. Chipping banner is there. P.O. Box is there if you want to send in a check. If you absolutely can't use PayPal, we prefer PayPal. And please donate and help us out if you can. I played this song earlier. I hadn't heard it in a while. I played it before the show. I was listening to Drive-By Truckers on the stream before. I heard this song earlier by Drive-By Truckers, the boys from Alabama. I hadn't heard this song in a long time. I'm going to play this song again because this song was just fucking rad. So here it is. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay with us.
We're going to take you up to McNary County, Tennessee. Back in the days when Sheriff Buford Pusser ran things around there. Sheriff Buford Pusser was trying to clean up McNary County, Tennessee from all them bootleggers that was bringing crime and corruption. sending illegal liquor into his little dry county. And for his troubles, he got ambushed. And his wife was murdered and his house got blown up. And they made a movie about it called Walking Tall. This is the other side of that story. Well, they caught you smoking grass, and the judge threw the book, and I saw a little opportunism in your look. You can take it from me, boy, take it from a crook. We have friends on the inside and friends on the outside. We'll sneak up beside just to keep on the good side. See you standing there staring down at your shoes, thinking about your mom and dad and wondering what to do. Well, you best look inside yourself, boy. We're all watching you. Well, your friends in jail who can see you through. Boy, don't forget, no matter what you do.
Can't keep my eyes from circling skies.
thing. No navigator to find my way home. Unladen, empty, and turned to stone.
Uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the show. Global Reality, Late Night Moonbat Edition with you here. Josh Reeves, your host. Thanks for being with us tonight for another show. And we're going to be reading more from Zechariah Sitchin's The End of Days in this segment of the show tonight. And we're, again, glad you could be with us. TheGlobalReality.com. That's TheGlobalReality.com. That's my website. And that's where you support our work. Chip and Banner, donate button, all that stuff is there. You can become a subscriber, and you can have it come out of your account every month, small amount, large amount. And we're totally publicly funded here. We don't have any outside support for coming in for the broadcast. Strictly on the support of our listenership, so... if you want to see us continue, to do big things, then we got to have your support, folks. So please help us out today if you can. Thanks so much. The End of Days. Oh, I want to mention real quick, for the people out there who make the YouTube videos of the shows and the different clips and stuff like that, I love you guys to do that. And there's more people doing that now. Thank you so much to everybody out there doing that. Please keep doing it. But I just had a request because, sometimes I get, you know, sometimes you get these questions. I get them so often and I've answered them, so often that I, you know, I hate him to go back and answer them again. So, so there are some times people have made the Zachariah Sitchin one really helped. But also I need one. If somebody knows, and I just recently talked about this on the show sometime in the past couple of months. I can't remember exactly what show it was, what day or month, but those of you who listen to the show might be able to remember what show that was. But if any, hold on a second. The cat's doing something weird. What are you doing? Stop it. No, stop it. He always wants to scratch his nails on something he knows he's not supposed to scratch his nails on when he knows I'm doing radio. Anyway, several months ago, I know it was real recent, somebody asked me about David Icke, and I talked about why, what I feel about David Icke, but the experience I've had interviewing him and going to an event that he had in New Mexico a couple of years ago. I had a question about that again. I don't feel like rehashing that. If somebody could find some of those shows where I've talked about the David Icke stuff, and kind of compile it into like a short little video and put that up on YouTube, that would be so fantastic and such a help to me if that's possible. I just wanted to put that request out there. So there you go. Let's get into end of days now. Picking up where we left off the other night. A clear example of the religious aspect of those wars and the deliberate choice of targets can be found in the Hebrew Bible in 2 Kings chapter 18 to 19, in which the siege of Jerusalem by the army of the Assyrian king Sennacherib is described. Having surrounded and cut off the city, the Assyrian commander engaged in psychological warfare in order to get the city's defenders to surrender. Speaking in Hebrew so that all in the city's walls could understand, he shouted to them the words of the king of Assyria. Don't be deceived by your leaders that your God Yahweh will protect you. Has any of the gods of the nations ever rescued their lands from the hand of the king of Ashur? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Avah? Where are the gods of the land of Samaria? Which of the gods of all of these lands ever rescued his land from my hand? Will then Yahweh rescue Jerusalem from my hand? Yahweh, the historical record show, did. What were those religious wars about? The wars and the national gods in whose name they were fought don't make sense except when one realizes that at the core of the conflicts was what the Sumerians had called Duran Ki, the bond of heaven and earth. Repeatedly, the ancient text spoke of the catastrophe when earth was separated from heaven, when the spaceport connecting them was destroyed. The overwhelming question in the aftermath of the nuclear calamity was this. What or who, which god and his nation could claim to be the one on earth who now possessed the link to the heavens? For the gods, the destruction of the spaceport in the Sinai Peninsula was a material loss of a facility that required replacement. But can one imagine the impact, the spiritual and religious impact on mankind? All of a sudden, the worship gods of heaven and earth were cut off from heaven. With the spaceport in the Sinai now obliterated, only three space-related sites remained in the old world. The landing place in the Cedar Mountains, the post-diluvial mission control center that replaced Nippur, and the great pyramids in Egypt that anchored the landing corridor. With the destruction of the spaceport, did those other sites still have a useful celestial function, and thus a religious significance? We know the answer to some extent because all three sites still stand on Earth today, challenging mankind by their mysteries, and the gods by facing upward to the heavens. The most familiar of the three is the Great Pyramid and its companions in Giza. Its size, geometric precision, inner complexity, celestial alignments, and other amazing aspects have long cast doubt on the attribution of its construction to a pharaoh named Cheops, an attribution supported solely by a discovery of a hieroglyph of his name inside the pyramid. In Stairway to Heaven, I offered proof that those markings were a modern forgery. And in that book and other voluminous textual and pictorial evidence was provided to explain how and why the Anunnaki designed and built those pyramids. Having been stripped of its radiating guidance equipment during the wars of the gods, the pyramid and its companions continue to serve as a physical beacons for the landing corridor, with the spaceport gone, They remain silent witnesses to a vanished past. There has been no indication that they ever became sacred religious objects. The landing place in the Cedar Forest has a different record. Gilgamesh, who went to it almost a millennium before the nuclear calamity, witnessed there the launching of a rocket ship. And the Phoenicians of the nearby city of Byblos on the Mediterranean coast depicted on a coin a rocket ship and placed on a special base within an enclosure at the very same place. And there's a picture of it here in the book. That's fascinating. I've never seen that before. It's a rocket on a fucking takeoff pad. That's exactly what it is. Almost 1,000 years after the nuclear event, so with and when without the spaceport, the landing place continued to be operative. The place, Baalbek, in Lebanon, consisted in antiquity of a vast 5 million square foot platform of paved stones at the northwest corner of an enormous stone structure. Oh, shit. Okay. Well, I get it now. Baalbek, which I'm very familiar with in Lebanon, Baalbek was the fucking landing pad. When you look at it like that, it makes total sense. Go look at Baalbek. I mean, my God. It's a platform of paved stones in the northwest corner of which an enormous stone structure rose heavenward. Built with perfectly shaped massive stone blocks weighing 600 to 900 tons each, its western wall was especially fortified with the heaviest stone blocks on Earth, including three that weigh an incredible 1,100 tons each and are known as the Trilithon. The amazing fact about these colossal stone blocks is that they were quarried about 2 miles away in the valley where one such block, whose quarrying was not completed, still sticks out from the ground. The Greeks venerated the place since Alexander's time as Heliopolis, the city of the sun god. The Romans built their greatest temple to Zeus. The Byzantines converted it to a great church. The Muslims, after them, built there a mosque. And present-day Maronite Christians revere the place as a relic from the time of the giants. A visit to the place and its ruins and how it functioned as a launch tower are described in the Earth Chronicles expeditions. Most sacred and hallowed to this day has been the site that served as Mission Control Center, Shalom, or Jerusalem, the city of the comprehensive God. There too, as in Baalbek, but on a reduced scale, a large stone platform rests on a rock and cut stone foundations, including a massive western wall with three colossal stone blocks that weigh about 600 tons each. It was upon that pre-existing platform that the temple to Yahweh was built by King Solomon. It's Holy of Holies with the Ark of the Covenant resting upon a sacred rock above a subterranean chamber. The Romans, who built the greatest temple ever to Jupiter in Baalbek, also planned to build one to Jupiter in Jerusalem instead of the one to Yahweh. The Temple Mount is nowadays dominated by the Muslim-built Dome of the Rock. Its gilded dome originally surmounted the Muslim shrine at Baalbek, evidence that the link between the two space-related sites has seldom been missed. In the trying times after the nuclear calamity, after Marduk's Babili, his gateway of the gods, substitute for the olden bond heaven-earth sites, could Marduk's new star religion offer an answer to the perplexed masses? The ancient search for an answer, it seems, has continued to our very own times. The most unremitting adversary of Babylon was the Assyrians. Their province in the upper region of the Tigris River was called Subartu in Sumerian times and was the northernmost extension of Sumer and Akkad. In language and racial origins, they appear to have had a kinship to Sargon of Akkad, so much so that when Assyria became a kingdom and imperial power, some of the most famous kings took the name Shahrukin-Sargon as their royal name. Sounds like something out of fucking Flash Gordon, doesn't it? Flash, savior of the universe. All that gleaned from archaeological finds of the past 2 centuries corroborates the succinct statements in the Bible, Genesis chapter 10, that listed the Assyrian kings among the descendants of Shem, and Assyria's capital, Nineveh, and other principal cities as a coming out of an outgrowth, an extension of Shinar, Sumer. Their pantheon was the Sumerian pantheon. Their gods were the Anunnaki of Sumer and Akkad. and the theophoric names of Assyrian kings and high officials indicated reverence to the gods Ashur, Enlil, Ninurta, Sin, Adad, and Shamash. There were temples to them, as well to the goddess Inanna Ishtar, who was also extensively worshipped. One of her best-known depictions as a helmeted pilot was found in her temple in Ashur, the city. Historical documents from the time indicate that it was the Assyrians from the north who were the first to challenge Marduk's Babylon militarily. The very first recorded Assyrian king, Elishuma, led circa 1900 BCE a successful military expedition down the Tigris River all the way south to the border of Elam. His inscriptions state that his aim was to set the freedom of Ur and Nippur, and he did remove for a while those cities from Marduk's grip. That was only the first fight between Assyria and Babylon in a conflict that continued for more than 1,000 years and lasted to the end of both. It was a conflict in which the Assyrian kings were usually the aggressors, neighboring each other, speaking the same Akkadian language, and both inheriting the Sumerian foundation. The Assyrians and Babylonians were distinguishable just by one key difference: their national god. Assyria called itself the land of the god Ashur, or simply Ashur, after the name of its national god. For its kings and people considered this religious aspect to be all that mattered. Its first capital was called City of Ashur, or simply Ashur. The name meant the one who sees, or the one who is seen. Yet with all the countless hymns, prayers, and other references to the god Ashur, it remains unclear who exactly in the Sumerian Akkadian pantheon he was. In god lists, he was the equivalent of Enlil. Other references sometimes suggest that he was Ninurta, Enlil's son and heir. But since whenever the spouse was listed or mentioned, she was always called Ninlil, the conclusion tends to be that the Assyrian Ashur was Enlil. The historical record of Assyria is one of conquest and aggression against many other nations and their gods. The countless military campaigns ranged far and wide and were carried on, of course, in the name of God, their god, Ashur. On the command of my god Ashur, the great lord, was the usual opening statement in the Assyrian king's record of a military campaign. But when it came to the warfare with Babylon, the amazing aspect of Assyria's attacks was its central aim. Not just the rollback of Babylon's influence, but the actual physical removal of Marduk himself from his temple in Babylon. The feat of capturing Babylon and taking Marduk into captivity was first achieved, however, not by the Assyrians, but by their neighbors to the north, the Hittites. Circa 1900 BCE, the Hittites began to spread out from their strongholds in north-central Anatolia, today's Turkey, to become a major military power and join the chain of Enlilite nation-states opposed to Marduk's Babylon. In a relatively short time, they attained imperial status, and their domains extended southward to include most of the biblical Canaan. The archaeology discovery of the Hittites, their cities, records, language, and history is an astounding and exciting tale of bringing life and corroborating the essence of people and places hereto known only from the Hebrew Bible. Hittites are repeatedly mentioned in the Bible, but without the disdain or scorn reserved for worshipers of pagan gods. He refers to their presence throughout the lands where the story and the history of the Hebrew patriarchs unfolded. They were Abraham's neighbors in Haran, and it was from the Hittite landowners in Hebron, south of Jerusalem, that he brought the Machpelah burial cave. Bathsheba, who King David coveted in Jerusalem, was the wife of a Hittite captain in his army. And it was from Hittite farmers who used the site for wheat thrashing that David brought the platform for the temple on Mount Moriah. King Solomon brought chariot horses from Hittite princes, and it was one of their daughters whom he married. The Bible considered the Hittites to belong genealogically and historically to the peoples of Western Asia. Modern scholars believe that they were migrants to Asia Minor from elsewhere, probably from beyond the Caucasus Mountains, because their language, once deciphered, was found to belong to the Indo-European group, as do Greek on the other hand and Sanskrit on the other hand as well. They are considered to have been non-Semitic Indo-Europeans, yet once settled, they added the Sumerian cuneiform script to their own distinct script, and included Sumerian loan words in their terminology. They studied and copied Sumerian myths and epic tales and adopted the Sumerian pantheon, including the count of 12 Olympians. In fact, in some of the earliest tales of the gods on Nibiru and coming from Nibiru were discovered only in their Hittite versions. The Hittite gods were undoubtedly the Sumerian gods, and monuments and royal seals invariably showed them the accompanied by the ubiquitous symbol of the winged disc. Now, I'm sorry. Oh, man, you don't understand how much gratification that piece of information right there gives me. I know a bunch of people that consider themselves pagans and all this stuff like that, and a lot of them are good people, but I just, every time I've been to one of these events with some of these pagans, I just want to scream and yell at them and go, don't you motherfuckers, because they're all, you know, you can just hear everybody,
Christians, stupid Christians, we've got it figured out, we're the pagans.
You know, you guys realize you're the same thing. Okay? Come on. The Hittites were the pagans, and they did the exact same thing with Christianity that they did with paganism. They had the exact same, I mean, they adopted that. Unbelievable. And they used the winged disc, the symbol for Nibiru. These gods were sometimes called in the Hittite text by the Sumerian or Akkadian names. We find Anu, Enlil, Ea, Ninurta, Inanna, Ishtar, and Utu Shamash repeatedly mentioned. In other instances, the gods were called by Hittite names. Leading them was the Hittite national god Teshub, the windblower, or the god of storms. He was none other than Enlil's youngest son, Ishkur Adad. His depiction showed him holding the lightning bolt as his weapon, usually standing upon a bull, the symbol of his father's celestial constellation. The biblical references to the extended reach and military prowess of the Hittites were confirmed by archaeological discoveries, both at Hittite sites and in the records of other nations. Significantly, the Hittite southward reach embraced the two space-related sites of the landing place, today's Baalbek, and the post-alluvial mission control center in Jerusalem. It also brought the Enlilite Hittites to within striking distance of Egypt, the land of Ra Marduk. The two sides thus had all it took to engage in armed conflict. In fact, the wars between the two included some of the ancient world's most famous battles fought in the name of God. But rather than attack Egypt, the Hittites sprung a surprise. The first, perhaps, to introduce horse-driven chariots in military campaigns, the Hittite army totally unexpectedly in 1595 BCE swept down the Euphrates River, captured Babylon, and took Marduk into captivity. Though one wishes that more detailed records from that time and event would have been discovered, what is known indicates that the Hittite attackers did not intend to take over and rule Babylon. They retreated soon after they had breached the city's defenses and entered its sacred precinct, taking Marduk with them, leaving him unharmed, but apparently under guard in a city called Hana, a place yet to be excavated in the district of Turka along the Euphrates River. The humiliating absence of Marduk from Babylon lasted 24 years, exactly the same time that Marduk had been in exile in Haran 5 centuries earlier. After several years of confusion and disorder, kings belonging to a dynasty called the Kassite dynasty took control of Babylon. They restored Marduk's shrine, took the hand of Marduk, and returned him to Babylon. Still, the Hittite sack of Babylon is considered by historians to have marked the end both of the glorious first dynasty of Babylon and of the old Babylonian period. The sudden Hittite thrust to Babylon and the temporary removal of Marduk remained an unresolved historical, political, and religious mystery. Was the intention of the raid just to embarrass and diminish Marduk, to deflate his ego, confuse his followers, or was there a more far-reaching purpose or cause behind it? Was it possible that Marduk fell victim to the proverbial hoist by his own petard? Oh, meaning Julius Caesar type, did he get JFK'd? Absolutely. Taken out by his own people? Yep, that's exactly what happened. What always happens, we still hadn't learned shit, even though this happens all throughout history, and we still think it's all isolated incidents, don't we? Well, that's the end of chapter 8 there. Zechariah said to the end of days. Chapter 9, the promised land, will be our next chapter that we'll pick up on next time on the broadcast. Fantastic stuff there tonight, that's for sure. Want to thank everybody for being with us. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com. We're going to be on Red Ice Radio. Don't forget that show is not live. I had people saying, oh, tune in Friday or whatever. No, you can't tune in. It's not live. We're taping it Friday, and then it'll be up to download, I think, in 2 weeks or so. So just sit tight and be patient, and good stuff to come. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. We need your support. Please donate if you can, folks. Don't have much in the old account right now, so anything would help. And if anybody out there wants to donate to get this next film done, please do so as well. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. You guys have yourself a great day, great night, great morning, whatever it is. Have a good one, and we will see you next time. Take care.